what this is, November 12th, 1990. This is Tom Murphy, and I'm interviewing John R. Shaw. John's a 1939 graduate of the university, and from 1948 until his retirement in 1978, he was manager of the university bookstore. And that, of course, is a subject of this interview. John joined the bookstore in 45, so it was only 3 years after he went on the staff that he became manager. So, John, I guess that the first thing would be to give some idea of the structure of the bookstore, the university bookstore, how it is tied in with the university.
The store was formed as a cooperative in 1882. We will be, I think they're planning a 100th anniversary celebration in 2 years. We started as a cooperative. It was started by three faculty members. In their first year of operation, they worked out of the law school building somewhere. And,
I'm just going to come up.
Okay. And can you stop that thing?
Yeah.
Briefly. In 1892, three faculty members decided that it would be economically feasible for them to start a co-op.
Okay.
Because everybody was individuals, individual faculty members, individual students were ordering their own books. It was kind of a shambles. So they started this thing in 1892. I have records around here somewhere that indicate their first year's business, their profit for the year was $7 after their first year. It went along until 1896 when it was reorganized. It was done by the original three. It was a very informal, very casual operation. And they elected officers and they wrote a trust, wrote a cooperative agreement. And it kept growing a little bit, but even by 1910, it was spectacularly unsuccessful. By 1910, they had sales of about $7,000. And they distributed, I recall, a number of around $1,500 to $1,800 in patronage refunds to their purchasers. But it didn't work out. And at this point, Charles N. Brown, and I remember him, I don't remember him individually, he was director of the State Historical Society.
Okay.
He had a friend who had gone to Harvard and knew about the Harvard Coop.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started a program to redesign this thing and reform this store, patterned after the trust indenture of the Harvard Cooperative. The Harvard Cooperative was not a co-op. It was a Massachusetts common law trust, which was a common form of cooperation in Massachusetts at that time. And so this group of men, under the leadership of Brown and others, came back to Madison, and from the period 1911 to 1912, they changed this institution, and it was formally adopted in 1914. And there's a wonderful record of this written in the Wisconsin Alumnus, and I think the July issue or the summer issue of the 1914 Wisconsin Alumni Magazine.
Okay.
The complete story of the reorganization and the program. They had problems because they had a membership arrangement. They had to get the people who were members to vote for this new structure, the new common law trust that they were going to form. That was accomplished in 1914. Cap Times had a Not the Times, one of the earlier newspapers had a wonderful editorial about the fraudulent use of student votes to change this from a true co-op to a common law trust. And it operated under this system for until 1933. Now, the common law trust was a simple device which allowed this institution, the University of Wisconsin, to operate a bookstore without having the university involved directly. They furnished no capital, they furnished nothing. The business furnished its own money. They raised their money through their sales and through their savings efforts and so on. And turn that thing off a minute, I've got to think about something. 1914, to go back here, in 1914, under the leadership of Brown and others, they adopted a trust indenture, a Massachusetts common law trust, which in 1914 was legal in Wisconsin. In 1916, Wisconsin passed a law that said common law trusts were no longer legal, that any new form of a trust business or a business operated like this, operated by a board, would have to become what is known as an unincorporated association.
Mm-hmm.
Several people tried to make an issue of that, and the State Department of Agriculture ruled in 1916 or 17 that the University Cooperative Company, which was the name of this Massachusetts Common Law Trust, could come in under a grandfathered clause and could continue its operation as it was, provided that the following parts of the trust indenture were retained. The trust, the Board of Trustees, were originally two faculty members appointed by the university, the president's office in this case, two alumni members chosen by the Wisconsin Alumni Association, and one student chosen by what is now the Wisconsin Student Association.
Mm-hmm.
That's since been amended to two faculty, two alumni, and three students over a period of time. They kept adding students. So and then the last addition was the manager of the store became really the eighth member, but was usually had the title of president of the board, but it was an ex officio office. And it operated under that basis for many, many years. Now, during this time, there was a fairly consistent growth. Their first store was in the 500 block on State Street, which you can't describe it anymore. It used to be a Chinese laundry during my youth. And
500 block on State Street.
Okay. And they moved across the street, you know, where Pickabook is now.
Yeah.
That was the first real bookstore at the University, the old University Co-op, University Bookstore. And you can still see, there's still some glass in there that would indicate that it was at one time a bookstore. Leaded glass decorations.
Oh, yeah.
They're still there. And that building was occupied in 1923 or 4, somewhere around there. And in 1927, I'm going to say 27,
okay.
I might be off 2 years, mm-hmm. I wish I had my notes. Approximately 1927, they made a deal with the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents to acquire the land on State and Lake for the university bookstore,
mm-hmm.
and leased the land and built their own building.
Okay, now that's the northwest corner. I'm just going to interject that here.
Northwest corner of where it was.
Yeah.
And that stood until 1970, mm-hmm. when the University Library addition was built,
yeah.
and then the university took it over. Then the store made a lease with the Lutheran Church across the street. Now, I think the thing that's significant here is what is the connection between the University of Wisconsin and the University Bookstore? And it is simply and only this one. They owned the land that the store was built on in modern times. Two, the chancellor or the president, in my time I was always the president. The
mm-hmm.
president appointed two faculty members. The Wisconsin Alumni Association, was supposed to appoint two members, but they seldom did.
Mm-hmm.
Arlie inquired about it a couple of times, and he said, what should I do with it? Somebody said, the rest of the board is not having any trouble selecting. We always have Wisconsin. I remember once we wanted a man on the board. I can't remember his name now. He was a lawyer in Milwaukee, but he was interested. They couldn't put him on because he wasn't an alumnus of the university.
Right.
He never went to the university.
Yeah.
He went to Yale. So we couldn't put him on the board. But we always had two alumni, two faculty, and three students. They must serve without pay. They must meet at least four times a year. They must declare the patronage refund if there is to be one declared. And they hire and fire, and they hire the management.
Okay.
That's their only function.
Okay.
That's all they do. that trust indenture is still in existence, has not changed, basically, since it was adopted in 1914. It's still in 1990. It's exactly the same trust indenture as being used today. It's been challenged by any number of people, one way or another, one time or another, but there's never been any basic change. The great advantage to the university is that the reason the university bookstore, and I'm going to say this parenthetically and probably inaccurately, the reason this is one of the best bookstores in the United States, and it is, and you can challenge that if you want to, anybody can, is because every nickel that it's ever earned has been plowed back into the business.
Okay.
There have been patronage refunds paid, but it's not a significant amount.
I was going to ask you, has that percentage varied much over the years,
only to the extent that it has increased? Now, some years, in the early years, they declared a patronage refund of 10% of your purchases, the members, this was in early 1900s,
mm-hmm.
the board declared, I remember this specifically, they declared a 10% patronage refund to their existing 1,800 members, who presumably bought quite a few books, and their profit that they had to distribute was $200.
Okay.
That's unrealistic. Generally, it has grown. Today, it's the highest. The patronage refund system has changed a little bit. You used to have to be a member. You came in and were assigned a number. You had to record that number, and then you saved your slips and came in.
Yeah.
Now it's strictly a cash register receipt.
Okay.
You save your cash register receipts and turn them in twice a year. And God, I think the patronage refund now is 7%.
All right. Now, if I can just interrupt you here, John, there was a time when staff and faculty got
10% discount.
Got dibs on a discount, and that has only changed in the last, 7, 8 years, think.
Even five.
Five, is it? Yeah.
It's not changed in my time.
Oh, did it?
I've been gone for, yes.
You're out of there in 78. Yeah.
78. I retired. I wasn't retired. I retired. Should have been. That was changed because of a federal law that everybody must be treated equally.
Oh, okay.
You cannot distinguish between classes of patrons. I doubt that the federal government would have ever looked at it if we had continued our 10% rebate, 10% discount to the faculty and to the staff. But it just looked to me at the time as a good idea to eliminate this practice. We wanted to do two things. We wanted to eliminate the charge account system, not because we were having any trouble with it, because we never did have any trouble with it in any large degree at all. Our faculty are generally very, very good charge customers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a class, if you can.
How about could students charge under the old charge account?
The students could not charge.
We
had two discriminatory things.
Well,
they could establish an account, but it was what we said, let's eliminate two problems. Let's eliminate the charge accounts, and let's eliminate the differentiated discount. So we went to master charge. So anybody can charge now. If you got a master charge, you can charge. We don't have individual accounts. Now, we never did close out Jim Watrous is a marvelous example. I'm not going to say to James Watrous, age 81. Sorry, James, after you've been trading here since 1932, I'm no longer going to allow you to charge. You know, this can't be done. but we now have very, very few charge accounts, so we don't open any new ones.
Okay.
So it's all Master Charge or Visa.
And
it works out better for us. Parents love it because they can control spending.
Sure.
More easily that way. So that's worked beautifully. Now, in 19, how long ago? So what I'm talking about up to now is the organization. The organization has basically been Massachusetts Common Law Trust from 1914 to 1990. Don't think it's going to change very much. I don't see any particular reason why it should. If it does change, about the only alternative would be for the university to take it over, which I don't think under the terms of the trust indenture it can be done. It has to go to court.
Okay.
And you don't have any idea what the court might decide to do. The Board of Trustees can't sell it. There's a real question as to whether they could even lease it. I don't think they can. Mm-hmm. I think I would personally challenge it if they attempted to lease it. The new wave in the book business, incidentally, today, of the 3,000 college stores in the country, I should all put in here parenthetically, when I talk about bookstores, I only talk about college stores.
Textbook, primarily.
I'm not talking about the,
the
Walden books and all the rest of them. Those are trade stores. But we are strictly a textbook operation, except with the exception, of course, of our Hilldale store. The only reason we have a Hilldale store, I'm jumping around too much here.
No, it's fine.
The only reason we have a Hilldale store is because our customers, our best trade customers, we have a very large and a very extensive trade department, are women. And there's no place to park, there's no light to come down there.
Yeah.
We had an opportunity to get a lease out here at Hilldale, and it has been spectacularly successful. We've acquired very few new customers. They're practically all the same old customers you always had, but they love it out here because they've got a parking place, they've got other places to shop.
Yeah.
And it's done very, very well. In fact, I'm going to make a prediction, which I may come true very soon, that within a year or two, if things continue as they are now, we will be selling more trade books, general books, fiction, nonfiction, paperbacks, in Hilldale than we do downtown.
Oh, okay.
But the growth in that business has been phenomenal.
Well, you don't sell any textbooks at Hilldale, do you?
No. We do as a favor.
They'll get it out there for you.
Get it out for somebody.
Yeah. John, was the original concept to sell books more cheaply to through the co-op than...
The original concept was to provide provide service.
Okay, it was not a price break anymore.
It was not a price factor, but there was a very simple reason. Textbooks, until 3 years ago, have been sold at list price, less 20% discount, plus freight. There isn't enough margin in there to give a discount. Any store in the past, until 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it's been going on for 10 years, more and more textbook publishers are publishing their books at not list less 20%, but at cost. And you can mark them anything you please.
I see.
The day of McGraw-Hill just announced within the week that they are going away from the list less 20, and they're going to a flat charge. The book cost you $7, and you can sell it for anything you damn please.
Yeah.
Result is that the so-called captive market that everybody's been so excited about over the years is no longer captive, because now stores can charge whatever they please.
I see.
We're the only store in the United States that's still selling books at 20%. There might be one or two. We have determined that that's...
Is that right?
What we're going to do. Nearly all stores are now selling at 25.
Okay.
why I, had I still, had I been there, had I stayed, I would have gone to the 25%.
Mm-hmm.
Although it would be pretty hard to justify because we've always made money. The big bleat in the industry has been that you can't make money at 20%. Mm-hmm. Well, you sure as hell can, but yeah. you've got to think about it a little different way than just straight, ordinary, everyday, unadulterated merchandising. You have to be, it's harder to do, but you can make money. We're a perfect example. We've made money for years and years and years, and we'll continue to make money. But what we've done with the money is what's remarkable. We've just pumped it back in the store. Mm-hmm. That's all good. The reason we're doing so well, and we are, is that we have the finest equipment, we've got one of the best facilities in the country, and it's all bought and paid for by us. But nobody makes any money. See, there's not a stockholder, there's not a, salaries are commensurate. The general manager, the president of the board, makes about what an associate dean makes. I mean, our salary scale is about...
Okay.
About like mm-hmm. the university, until the university got into this $100,000 bid where we got faculty members making $125,000. I think John is, I don't know what he makes now, but he's one of the highest paid bookmen in the country.
Okay.
And he's under the price of a dean on this campus.
Okay.
Still.
All right.
The average salaries are still pretty low in the book business. Book business is, let me go at it another way. There are 3,000 college stores in the country, and until very recently, the last few years, 2,500 of them, 2,400 of them, been owned and operated by the institution they serve. Very few privately owned stores.
Okay.
When I left the book business 12 years ago, there were fewer than 200 private stores in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are many more because, as I say, the name of the game is now lease. There are four big companies. Barnes & Noble is the principal one, who are leasing stores from, are operating the stores for the institution. They'll come in here and say, look, we'll run your store. And most colleges lose money on their college stores.
Yeah.
So this lease business has been very, very important.
Okay.
There's a big group there's a terrible battle going on in the National Association of College Stores that the private store operators are saying, the institutional store managers are saying, you're selling us down the river, you're favoring the lease store.
Yeah.
And it's a very bitter. Very bitter debate going on right now.
All right, that's good, John. That's a good.
That's very interesting. So the ownership concept of college stores is changing. These stores are becoming bigger and more important. God, Wilcox Follett, or the Follett Corporation, I guess they call it now, I think they own 500 stores in the United States. And they're beginning to control the market. Walden is controlling. The company that operates the Walden Books is the largest. I don't know if they're the largest or Wilcox Follett is or Barnes & Noble is. I don't know. I don't have accurate figures. You could get them from John. How well do you know John?
Well, fairly well.
Because he's having his problems with the university right now.
Yeah.
He's...
Well, that's all right.
Whatever we're talking.
Well, it is related in the sense that this.
Right.
Okay, cool.
I started out in the book business in 1932 at Brown's Bookshop. And the date was February 9th, 1932, and the reason I know that's the day I got my driver's license.
Oh, okay.
And I started as a mail clerk. And I had to have a driver's license to haul the mail back and forth to the post office. We delivered our own mail to the post office for shipping and so on. And I picked up the mail in the morning. I was going to Madison West High School. And I would go to work in the morning, get the mail, sometimes took Mr. Emmy to work, sometimes he took me to work, the boss, the owner. And then I came back after class, I'd come down and help close the store and go home with Mr. Emmy. We were neighbors. Mm-hmm. My sister worked at Bounds. And I worked there until 1939, when, 38 I guess it was, 39, and I went to California, because the streets are paved with gold, as you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I went to work for California Book Company in Berkeley, and I stayed there until 1942.
Okay, so all your working career.
I never had any job in the world except working in the bookstore. And I had my own store. I was a chain. California mm-hmm. Book is a chain, and I ran my own store in San Jose, and then in the summertime I was a book buyer. I ran around all over the West Coast buying books from students. And we had a good operation and a good store. Well, I came back, and Mr. Emery was always trying to get me to come back, because I liked him and he liked me, and we were good friends, and my parents and the Emerys were good friends.
Mm-hmm.
My sister had worked there for years. So after the war, I got out of service and came back. And I didn't want to go back to Berkeley. I'd been and left Madison in 39, and my parents were very elderly at that time, and my mother was ill, and my dad was sick, and I said, oh, I'm not going to go back. So I went to work for Brown's, and I worked a month or two, and it just wasn't working out. I wasn't happy there, and they weren't exactly happy with me, because Mr. Emery had sold out and Merle Gribble had taken over the business. I was a bookman. It was my business. That's what I knew. It was a textbook business.
Mm-hmm.
And Gibb was interested in non-textbook business. He wanted to push the book business back in the corner and sell a more profitable merchandise, logically and reasonably and intelligently. That wasn't for me. So I went over to see Doug Stewart, who was a friend of mine. I'd known him for years. And I said, Doug, I have to have a job. I don't have any money. And I was married, I think that was 1940. I can't remember when Ellen was born. We were going to have a baby, or something was going to happen. I needed a job. So I said to Doug, would you let me work here for a while till I get kind of organized? And he said, geez, come on. I need all the help I got. Hideous swamp.
Yeah, so you're getting the student boom. Excuse me, but this was the 46 you're talking
1946,
about. 1946. So the boom was...
Yeah,
oh,
sure.
Yeah.
And the GI thing was going like crazy.
Yeah.
And he, my first and immediate job with the co-op, the old co-op, was to straighten out a terrible mess of the NROTC problem. We had a contract to buy back all the books. See, the Navy furnished NROTC students their textbooks. But the Navy, in its infinite wisdom, made them bring them back. You know, they wouldn't let them keep them. So here's an engineer going to school, and he'd have to sell his engineering books back at the end of the first semester and buy another set. And it was a shambles. But so he said, go to the university and see if we can't work out something on this NROTC deal. And he says, we'll talk about, and it was the kind of stuff I liked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I worked on that for 6 months, trying to get that organized. And through that, I met John Cameron, and you remember all of these guys? Les Mayfield, these are the GI, the federal people who were working on the campus, and the NROTC people, the ROTC and all that. Bud Foster was in charge, and, you know, Bud, one of the nicest guys who ever walked the face of the earth.
Yeah.
What he knew about the book business, I could write on the head of a pin in 12-point type. Well, geez, I guess if you say they're worth so much, well, that's what I'll give you for it. But he would write these goddamn checks. Whoa, it was a shambles. So we worked on that, got that organized, and that's how I got to marching around the campus, talking to faculty, and say, look, help us arrange some kind of a deal so that we don't have to take these books back from the students. This is crazy. This is insane. It's educationally insane for us to have to do this. And they agreed. This is how I got started.
Okay.
To make a long story short, gradually I worked in there, and slowly but surely I was taking over the textbook operation. And our man, Eddie Toppelman, who was, again, a nice guy, was just not qualified. He didn't know what he was doing. I'm not saying this critically or unkindly.
Toppelman?
Eddie Toppelman.
Nice. That's the one they called Toppy.
Toppy, sure. Yeah. He was snowed. He didn't have adequate health. He didn't have any facilities. He didn't have any space. Because the store was all, great. The whole basement was taken up by the new sporting goods department.
Yeah. Now let me just interrupt there. That was Douglas. What was the name of that sporting goods outfit?
Well, no, that was University Bookstore. That was the co-op sporting goods department.
Oh, I thought there was. I thought I had an item. I remember C.W. Andrus Clothing was in men's clothing.
Bill Randall ran the women's department.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
Randall lease department. Yeah. That's what Doug was good at. He had all these lease departments in there. He had the lease shoe department.
Okay.
He had Ed Olson ran the shoe department. Charlie Andrus ran the men's department. Bill Randall ran the women's department. And Doug and his wife ran the gift department and the supply department.
Oh, okay.
And Eddie Toppelman ran the book department.
Oh, okay.
That was the least.
Right. I remember the physical layout of much of it.
It was terrible. It was a shambles. So what I did without, I tried to run it so that I could live with it. I mean, I got interested and got excited about it. I said, Jesus, we got a huge opportunity here. And it would be kind of fun to shake up old Gribble. I said, we've got to have space. We've got to have more room in the book department. We have to have it. We can't survive. So the first department we got rid of was the sporting goods department. Jeez, I forgot there was another one. A guy named Gil Malmison, I'd forgotten about him. He was down in the basement, too. He sold, he was a wholesaler of paper goods. Worked on a commission,
Yeah.
So we got rid of him, and we got him set up. I found him a place with an old Postweiler over on University Avenue and got him moved. Got him out of there, and I got some space. Then I took over that space. Then the next one was Chubby Goodlad, and that was a terrible shambles. I mean, it was hard. But Doug didn't want to let him go, but I said, Doug, I got to have more room for the book.
Now, what was he? What was Goodlad?
Sporting Goods.
Sporting Goods. Okay.
He came from the one of the big downtown sporting goods stores. Okay. Always wanted his own shop. Wonderful guy. More fun than a barrel of monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
He was just marvelous. But just a shambles. So then to get that out of there. Then Bill Randall wanted out, and I said, "Oh, wonderful, good." But he euchred me and sold it to the Yosts, and they wanted to stay.
Mm.
So, but gradually, I talked the Yosts into moving into the shop next door,
mm-hmm.
where we expanded our general book department later. That's all I did was expand, and finally got them all moved out. As their leases ran out, I said I'd cancel the leases. So by 1966, I had the entire building to myself, plus the Taylor building next door. I bought the building next door, which had four shops in it, and that was added to it. That's what I did.
Okay.
And then run around to the faculty and say, we're going to take care of you. We've got enough room now. We can
mm-hmm.
solve some of your problems. You
mm-hmm.
see, we had difficulty with furnishing enough books. The enrollment went from 6,000 or 7,000 to 18,000 in 3 years.
Yeah.
It just blew up. And that's what I did. That was mm-hmm. my skill. Well, finally, in 1940. Eight or nine, I don't remember what year. Doug and I had a terrible blow up and then quit.
You quit?
Oh, sure.
Oh, did you?
Oh, it was terrible. Just an awful shambles. And I'm forgetting the most important thing I did. I got people on the board who wanted to be on the board instead of having Ed Young or whoever it was.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Connie Elvium. He didn't He didn't want any part of this. He didn't want any. He said, if you think of somebody that would be good on the board, you tell him and I'll appoint him. But I couldn't get to. He said, well, people, why would you go work on this thing? Everybody was mad at the store because we weren't doing a good job. And finally, I talked. The first one was Kurt Wendt. Talked him into coming onto the board. No, he wasn't the first one. The first one was Rudy Froker, because Rudy Froker, dean of the ag school.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to get deans. I wanted to get some status. I wanted to go.
Yeah.
Instead of being the orphan of the university, I wanted to be go, go, go. Rudy Froker came on. Then Kurt went. And then my triumph was, that's the wrong word, but finally got John Guy Fawkes to get on, because he's noisy. That's what I wanted. I wanted somebody
to
get up there and pound on the table and say, God damn it, we got to do this. We got to get this. Go, 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 go.
Okay.
So anyway, Doug and I just weren't getting along at all. So I quit. And I was home. I was writing letters.
Excuse me, give me that last name. Doug who?
Doug Stewart.
Stewart. Stewart. Okay, just so that.
Douglas Stewart.
Okay.
A wonderful guy.
Yeah,
again.
Yeah.
But again, he was interested in different. He didn't want to run a bookstore. He wanted to be a promoter.
And a
landlord and all this kind of stuff. So I was sitting home. I remember I was writing to Daniels in Berkeley in California. I said, Daniel, I was writing a letter. Barbara hollered upstairs. She said, John Guy Fawkes is here. He wants to talk to him. I thought she was kidding.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I want to talk to him. Tell him to go home. Anyway, he said, I want to talk to you. He said, I didn't quit. I was fired.
Okay.
Doug fired. And he said, I understand Stewart fired you. And I said, yes. He said, he doesn't have the authority to do that. And I said, well, I don't give a damn whether he does or not. He did, and that's fine. I'm glad to be out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, we've been working on it. We're going to hire you back. And I said, no way. I'm not going to come back. Well, I said, we're at the opposite ends of the book business. We don't understand each other. We can't work together. He said, you're not going to work together. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, we're going to open a new store, and you're going to run it. And you're going to be in complete, totally independent.
Oh.
Well, I said, that won't work. He said, well, it will. And we opened a store on University Avenue, a so-called technical bookstore.
Oh, all right.
And I ran that for, I guess, 3 months. And,
at least how long?
3 months.
Okay.
And going just... We were going like crazy. Of course, I had Kurt Wendt supporting it.
Yeah.
And Rudy Froker supporting it. And John Guy. Everybody was doing this.
And heavy demand, because that was the technical end of the campus, and heavy, and lots of all the vets were going into engineering and stuff. Okay. Yeah.
And one day John came in and he says, well, it's time to move back downtown. I said, boy, I'm not going to go. He said, yeah, we're going to run the big store. I said, no. He said, yes, you are. He said, you're all. He said, Mr. Stewart is no longer with us.
No. Okay.
He's left by mutual agreement.
Oh, all right.
And those are hard days.
Yeah. What year was this, John?
I'm going to say 1948, maybe 49.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know when that little piece we did on you, we had you as manager from 48 to 30, but I thought maybe that included. Oh, well, 3 months only over
there. I wasn't there long enough.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, then it is 48.
And it was a tough thing. Well, it was the best thing that ever happened to Stewart, because he finally got into what he wanted to do. We formed the Douglas Stewart Company, and he was a manufacturer. While he was working at the store, he ran a drawing board company. He made drawing boards up in Owen, Wisconsin. And he ran that on the side. He had other things going all the time. And he started the Douglas Stewart Company, which is still a very, very successful wholesaler of student supplies. He works all over the country.
Okay.
Well, he's dead now. He's long gone. But it started a very fine organization. The Douglas Stewart Company was very successful. And I got freed up and And then's when I started to get rid of my leased apartments.
Yeah.
Really expand. So by 1966, we were...
They were out of there.
They were all gone, and then I at that time I realized we had to... That wasn't going to be big enough. That wasn't going to save us at all. So I started to negotiate for new space and ended up across the street. But that's what I did. That was my contribution to the university bookstore. Was I made it grow.
Yeah.
I made a real bookstore out of it and made it grow.
Yeah, you sure did. I had a note on this story about you that you there were 3,000 titles when you went in there in 45, and you ended with 50,000 by the time you. And these are all textbook titles we're talking about.
At least.
John, you said earlier that you had to win over much of the faculty because...
Well, they couldn't get any service.
What I want to ask. How was it that the bookstore was not ordering the text that they put on their syllabus?
They weren't doing a good job.
I see.
See if I can think of it. I remember... so many. They just wouldn't order enough books. The first place, they didn't have enough money to order.
Okay.
And they never ordered as many as Charlie Edson, I remember Charlie. He ordered, he was teaching ancient history, and he ordered X number of books, and he came in there one day, and he came storming up the office. He says, "God damn it! I ordered 60 copies of this, and you've got 5 copies now."
Oh, I see.
And I said,
okay.
"Well, maybe they've been sold." I don't know. I don't. And so we would talk, and then, so then, what I really did was establish a system of record keeping so that we could demonstrate to the faculty that just because you order, you Murphy come in here and say, "I'm going to sell 65 books," that doesn't mean that 65 students are going to buy 65 books.
Uh-huh,
you don't know.
Uh-huh. So
we have to work out a system here. And then we have to get some cooperation with our competitors, and all this stuff.
Right, is there a simple formula for that system?
No.
Huh?
We just got aggressive and kept ordering more and more and more. And then we took some terrible lumps. We took some terrible beatings because I ordered too many. But I said to my staff, and I was, in the meantime, getting a real strong, tough, good staff. Do you remember Irv Anton?
Mm-hmm. Probably might by name. But
yeah, well, he would be a little short, stocky, looked like a bulldog, was a bulldog. I said, "Irv, you get one responsibility." He used to worry a lot. He said, "Geez, I don't know if we should order that many." I'd say, "Order thus and so," and I'd check. And he hadn't ordered. He said, "I'm never going to sell them. I'll get fired." I said, "Irv, you got only one responsibility. That's to never run out of a textbook."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "That's when you're going to get fired.
Mm-hmm.
Not because you got too many, but because I'll take care of the surplus. You make sure we
get."
And we built up this staff. And I got a wonderful staff going there. And,
what time frame would you normally take, and is the logical time from the time to get texts for a particular course in English history? For when did Napland have to tell you what he was going
to
read?
He had to tell me 8 or 10 weeks in advance.
Yeah, that
this
all
was the problem,
okay.
And he would.
And they wouldn't. Yeah.
And this was just a whole. We generated. Created a whole new system for textbook ordering and for textbook returns and it took an awful lot of doing, but we finally got it. Then the other thing we did that the students loved, we really got into the used book business. We really pushed hard on that, and I hired 2 of the best used book men in the country.
We pushed on that.
The students recognized
that. I remember selling them back at the end of the semester all through school.
In the old days, you couldn't sell them back, or you sell them back dying or something.
And we made it. The vets had that was a good deal because the government paid for it in the first place, so it was a clear profit.
Well, see, that was my first experience. That was the NROTC program. That's what I was talking about earlier. The NROTC forced the Navy students to turn their books in. They were given them, and then they had to turn them in. If they didn't get them in, they got a demerit or something.
Yeah.
So here's a guy. he'd take a descriptive geometry course for a year, and they made him turn in his first semester book. He didn't have to buy another book for the second. So then they couldn't keep the books. They couldn't but give them a dictionary, and then to take it away from them at the end of the semester. The next semester they wouldn't. So they wouldn't. Well, you had a dictionary. Well, you made me turn it in. Well, I'm oversimplifying it, but.
But I know, I understand. Okay, so then you had the whole move then across the street then too, didn't
well,
you?
Well, then that was my next job, was to negotiate. A.W. Peterson, rest his soul, Alfred Waldo Peterson, told me in front of the board, John, I said, we got to have more space. We got to have another space. This isn't big enough. It's not going to be big enough. The library's going to take it over. We all know this. We got to get out of here. I'll take care of it, Alfred Waldo Peterson said. Don't worry about it. Only trouble is he forgot to tell anybody else. And to make, so I negotiated. I negotiated for the University Club. I tried desperately to get the University Club. And I said, what I said was, my proposition was, you let me have the space and I will build a store and run it. And I'll give you a University Club on top of it for free. I negotiated, and Jim Watrous buried that. I negotiated for Chadburn Hall. Said, give me the Chadburn Hall corner and we will help you construct the dormitory on top of it. They just couldn't see it. Nobody could see it. And finally, I got really super desperate. Then there were all those plans for parking University Avenue, and they said, no, I'll never move south of University Avenue, which was a mistake. I could have been on the corner parking you right now, where WHA is now, if I'd been smart. But I couldn't see it at the time. It was 30, 40, God, it was 40 years ago. I finally got very desperate, and I learned very accidentally that the Lutherans were very desperate, and they had that beautiful corner.
Yeah.
The little church, the little stone church, remember the little pretty little sandstone church there? And they were, the damn thing was falling down, and they needed a new church, and they didn't have any money. Because they were not a separate parish. They were a separate church. They were supported by all the other synods.
Oh, okay.
And I finally got, we negotiated for more than 2 years.
They didn't have the land all the way to the alley, though, did
they? Yes, sir.
Oh, there was a barber shop?
Yeah,
and they owned it all, the church under the Lutheran.
Paul's bookstall was in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the barber shop, and Abe the dry cleaner.
There'd been a coffee shop or something.
Yes,
I remember.
There was a coffee shop in there, and the barber shop.
But the Lutheran...
They owned it all. They owned it, at least those. So I said, you give me the right to use your land for 50 years, and I'll build you a new church. And they said, I'll never forget the first meeting. One old guy, and he was from Pekin, Illinois. I was dealing with the church retirement board. They had lots of money, and they didn't know how to invest it. They wanted to do something that would keep it in the church.
Yeah.
And this was the way that was. I said, you loan me the money to put up the building. I'll pay for it in 50 years. And you're home free. You own this building, and then you can lease it back to me. And this old guy, nice old guy, all crippled up, and he walked with a cane. He got out of the meeting. He said, I've heard some crazy pipe dreams in my time, but nothing as crazy as this. And walked out. But we finally got it put together and worked. Make a long story short, what we did there finally was they gave us the land. They gave us the use of the land for free for 50 years. And we built the church and the store and leased it. We're paying for it in 50 years. And then it's theirs. And I don't know what the hell we'll do.
I was going to say, you got 20 years out of that, 50 is gone. It's not almost.
More than that, because the deal was done in 1957.
Okay,
We didn't move in. And, no, 57, I'm wrong. The deal was done. We moved in 1970, I know that. The deal was done, it was 3 years before we actually
actually moved into the building. So it was 3 years lost.
Yeah.
Because we had to pay the construction costs too, you know. That's expensive. But anyway, that's we have a lease with the church, and it's to our great advantage. I'll never know why they ever signed it. I'll never know.
Terrific, though.
I don't. But they're not unhappy with it. Now this is turn off the machine.
Get you back on some more, John, about students and thievery of bookstore in the bookstore.
There's no dramatic change in it. It goes in cycles. There was a time in the, I'm going to use the word the Troubles, the Civil War. During the 60s and 70s, we had some very difficult times with theft, with terrible vandalism, just incredible. We spent, 1 year, we spent $260,000 just repairing broken windows.
Those plate glass windows. Yeah. Now we're talking about the old store.
The old store, we're still in the old store. And you remember how we boarded them up and then we bricked them up.
Yeah.
Finally that became just solid brick, and the new store is poured concrete. That is not by accident. That was done on purpose. Yeah. That store would be very difficult to break into. But the pilferage, it was the style, it was the thing. The University Bookstore and State and Lake, that includes Rennebaum's and it includes Never Paul's, incidentally, Never Paul's bookshop. He never had any vandalism,
he never had
any particularly difficult theft. But it was the big entrepreneur types,
the establishment,
bookstore, the establishment, blah, blah, blah. Then we had some terrible times, some terrible vandalism, some terrible, we had fires, we had, it was a mess.
Yeah.
But today, and then we adopted a very aggressive, after we got into the new store particularly, we adopted a very aggressive anti-theft control system. Which I don't think did anything but offend people. I don't think it changed.
Are you talking about the lockers in the lobby?
No, the lockers worked fine.
Yeah.
Now, if we charged for the lockers, that wouldn't work. See, those lockers are free.
Yeah.
You put your quarter in, then you get the quarter back. No, that didn't. I think we prosecute. If you got caught, you were prosecuted.
Yeah.
And if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't do that.
Oh.
I would selectively prosecute, and then you get in more trouble over that. But we had some very, very difficult times over prosecution. We had faculty members as well as students. But, you know, anybody's. I know one case where I know that woman did not intend to steal it, but she just forgot
and dropped it.
I wouldn't change my policy. It was stupid, and I wouldn't change it. That got me in an awful lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I also know a wife of a very prominent faculty member was arrested and convicted, and she was guilty, of course, and that caused an incredible amount of trouble in a public relations sense. I think students today, 1990, now remember, I haven't been there for 12 years, I don't think they're as bad as they were earlier on. I don't think there is. I know the vandalism thing
is way down, yeah.
It's way down.
Yeah.
We had, just incredible damage done to the store.
John, outstanding faculty or administrators, that outstanding in your mind for whatever reason through the bookstore operation, are there any that come to mind as outstandingly helpful? Obviously Wendt and John Guy Foulkes and some of those
my board and Harold Kubley was very helpful. Fred Lydell, Marvin Schars was a very positive influence. He helped us a lot with the Alumni Association.
Okay.
He helped solve some problems there because he was president of the Madison what, Madison?
Madison Alumni Club, it would be, yeah.
And he solved some problems for us. He was difficult because he was a true cooperator.
Okay.
I forgot to tell you a funny story. My father was a cooperator.
Okay.
My father was an officer of the Martel insurance company, the little country insurance companies, fire and windstorm insurance company.
Yeah.
He was a founding board member of the Pierce County Creamery and all this. When I told him that I was going to take a job at the university co-op in 1946, he said, "I never thought I'd raise a son to take a job with a terrible dump like that. That's not a cooperative. That's a phony." Oh, God, he was mad at me. So, but, I can think of so many I'm trying to think of a guy. Who was the very popular history professor?
Oh boy, I don't know.
Usually related to commencement. Commencement was a difficult time.
Oh yeah.
Commencement is the only time where everybody gets uptight. Commencement is a difficult period for a lot of people because they either. They don't know whether they're going to make it or not, or they are going to make it. Or so it's very important to families and to mess up a commencement, and we've done it. See, I was on the Public Functions Committee for many, many years, and my job on the Public Functions Committee was to make certain that everybody had proper academic attire.
Uh-huh.
And there's about 10,461 versions of what proper academic attire is, and people get very intense about it. I can remember people who said, "This is the wrong, I got the wrong hood." Mm-hmm. You know, and I said, "What the hell's the difference? Who cares?"
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
You try to put a University of New Hampshire hood on a Harvard PhD, and you're going to end up with your eyes poked.
Now you're talking about the students too, is faculty?
We're talking about faculty now.
You're right. Okay. No, but as you got in, but the students also got their caps and gowns through you, didn't they?
Everybody. There's a cap and gown that came through the store, and it's a very traumatic, very difficult thing to do to get everybody in the right size and the right. In the proper attire, according to their lights, we had Dean Rundle, law school. Did you ever know him?
Who?
Dean Rundle of the law school.
Well, no, I didn't know him personally.
A man you'd have to describe. I hate the term describing a man, but he was number one. He's a gentleman, but he was a nice guy. He was kind of sweet. He didn't get all worked up about it. And he saw somebody from the University of Indiana with a Indiana gown and an Indiana music hood. Well, pink is the color for music, and purple is the color for law. But it seems that Ollie liked pink, so he said, "Give me one of those hoods." I said, "Well, it's Dean, I'll get." But that's a doctor of music from Indiana University. "I don't care," I said, "that's the one I want to wear." So, for the fun of it, I did. Got him. And, you can't believe the people that got,
upset.
"Dean Rundle has not got on a proper hood." he didn't bother him at all.
He liked pink.
He liked pink. Yeah. It was pretty. And pink and red, you know. God, what a combination. I would say the man that I relied on as much as anybody wasn't a faculty member, it was Alden White. Alden White.
Alden
secretary
White.
Of the faculty.
Okay, White, yeah.
Oh, he was.
Yes, I guess he was great. A very dynamic, wonderful guy.
He got me into a lot of scrapes and got me out of a lot more.
Okay.
He did things that he put me on committees where I wasn't. I'm not a faculty member.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And he put me on the I'm the one that made everybody the maddest was he put me in the faculty directory.
Okay.
"Well, this man's not in the faculty." Who cares?
Yeah.
How many times do you call him? Well, I call him. Well, why should you have to look in the city directory?
Exactly.
So he did things like, and then when he put me on the public function committee, and the committee barked at him and they said, we don't want a non-academic on the public functions committee. Okay. And he says, I don't give a damn whether you want one or not. You've got one and he's going to stay on.
Which made good sense.
Well, sure. Arlie was always Arlie always wanted to wear
red. I suppose a red gown.
No, he wanted a PhD. He said, "Geez, I want one of those fancy ones with the velvet." I said, "Arlie, I said that's a PhD. You know that. You get a master's. I'll give you the master's gown. Do look awful silly."
Yeah.
So I'll make a long story short. I finally got him a nice, big, full, voluminous bachelor's gown that he liked the looks of, and had some stuff on it that shut him up because he hated his sleeves hanging out of it. But every year, give me one of those.
Give me the PhD. Oh, that's funny.
Oh, Ed Young. Absolutely.
Lovely guy, huh?
Just marvelous.
Delightful guy, yeah.
Ralph Hewitt, another one of my favorites. You probably didn't know him. I knew him because I was faculty advisor for the Sigma Nu fraternity. Mm-hmm. We were the first fraternity kicked off the campus because of our restrictive clauses.
Oh, yeah.
And Ralph was on the committee that threw us out.
Okay.
But got to be a very good friend.
Okay, I'm happy. Is okay. that